Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 57. On this episode, we're talking about Cinderella. Cinderella has been hugely popular this year. It isn't necessarily a surprise, a Disney movie, a retelling of the classic story, not a reinterpretation or a reimagining, but a straight retelling just in live action form. Helping me talk about it, or sing about it, as it were, is Laura Fissel and Joe Darnell, no strangers to the show themselves. We get into many great conversations about the merits of always being courageous and always being kind, where magic fits into our lives, the need for intervention, even when doing everything you can. And we discuss which is more empowering, vengeance or forgiveness. We may also talk about video games a little bit, and like I said, we may sing a lot. So here it is, episode 57, Cinderella and Overcoming with Kindness. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Yeah, and you want to know something really cute? When I was a little boy...
More than anything.
When I was a little boy, my thing was... finding daddy's headphones, put them on, sitting at his desk, pretending that I was working.
Man, it's all in the
full circle.
Yeah. Man. Here I am.
Circle.
It's inescapable.
Yeah, I guess I spent a lot of time as a kid at my grandma's typewriter, typing nonsense.
I feel like
What'd you do, little Mikey?
Yeah, I'm going to say, I feel like I should have some kind of equally creative story that shows how it was inevitable that one day I would be a world-class podcaster. Yeah. And all I can think of is, like, I played a lot of video games. I'm sure you could tell when I was working my way through Final Fantasy that this man is going to one day want to talk a lot. So,
yes.
I have no idea.
Weren't the Final Fantasy games worth it? I always admired the concept, and I was flabbergasted by their popularity, but I never actually bought a title.
I love the Final Fantasy series up until about 8 or so.
Really? Because the only one I've played the whole way through is 9,
well,
and I really liked it.
I do like 9. I thought 9 was a pretty solid game, but I can say up through like 1 through 7 were ones that I would recommend. Some are going to be not really some people's cup of tea because of the battle system or the job class system that they implement in some of the early ones. But if that doesn't bother you, then all those games are really good. Still, probably my favorite stories are in what the U.S. releases were Final Fantasy II and III. I thought those stories were incredible. I think it's actually like 4 and 6, I think.
Which was the one you were playing when I was watching?
That was Final Fantasy III, which again I think is 6. But it's been a while since I looked up the number. Yeah, yeah. The numbers. So, but those stories are great, and I love playing them now. You know, like Super Nintendo graphics.
Sweet.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think the stories are so cool. Like that was me being able to play out my childhood angst.
Mm-hmm.
Through these characters who were like falling in love and people were dying, and you know, like it, I mean, like, because most video games were, you know, you shoot something, it explodes, you win.
Oh yeah.
You know, there were, or like, you know, you die but you lost a life and you just came back.
Sure.
Was Final Fantasy like one of the first that did like story? Was it story RPG?
No, it wasn't one of like the first, but I think they did it really well.
One of the best franchises at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, things have changed, and so like it's a lot of story and they try to add cool things here and there. And honestly, I haven't played one in quite a while. We have a couple friends that would probably be better on it. But between the Final Fantasy games that were released for Super Nintendo and Chrono Trigger, which was also released by Square, those are games that make me wish I had more time. You know, so, you know, like you'll watch a really great series on TV, right? And you'll be like, man, I remember watching through whatever series it was. Like, oh, I remember watching through The Office, and it was so great going on that journey with the characters and stuff. And sometimes you'll long for a good show that you really love. I love watching Star Trek The Next Generation over and over and over again. And I wish, like, at any time I could put an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation on. And sometimes I wish I had an entire week off so I could watch all 7 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Nice.
with nothing else to do, because it holds such a dear place in my heart.
Retiring.
Who's going to retire when you do awesome things like this for not money? So always have something to watch, always have something to do. But that's how I feel about those video games. Like, I don't get to play a lot of video games hardly at all now.
Yeah, me neither. But I would if I had the time.
Yeah, but it's just a time thing. You know, I have no problem with people playing video games. I think video games are actually really cool, and they can be creative outlets depending on which games you play and how much time you spend with them, because I feel like I'm a pretty creative person. Laura tells me I'm a fairly creative person, and I basically spent my entire youth playing video games.
You turned out okay.
Yeah, I feel like I turned out okay.
If you're not okay, I'm not okay.
But yeah, man, I really do wish when I think about like what I would do if I had all the time in the world, I would duplicate myself so I could go, like, one guy could just be playing Final Fantasy and Chrono Trigger all the time. More than any other game that I've ever played, you know. I love games like Mario Kart and things like that. But like, that's not something that like I want to like rearrange my schedule for.
Interesting.
Anyway, so maybe that's it. Maybe that's how I bring this full circle. I realized from a young age that I love great stories.
Yeah. There you go.
And so I would spend more time playing Final Fantasy games and, you know, renaming all my characters to people I knew in real life, you know, having to go through these trials of betrayal and death.
I like to do that on Oregon Trail.
Yeah, but that was kind of a different, like, you just wanted to know who's going to get dysentery, right?
So right. It was still a connection to my real life.
How many of my friends are going to die when I ford the river?
They could be like, no!
Gosh, I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to talk. I keep getting this junk in my throat.
You got some of the pollen up in there.
Yeah, everything's bad right now. Everything's a blooming. So
it's pretty rough, but I bet you over the weekend it's going to be a disaster here. So,
well, we have a all day outdoor gardening plan on Saturday, so I'm trying to get it all done like in one day. So if I die, you know, I know what day it's going to be.
It's just done.
Yeah. Yeah, like I can just, like at the end of the day when I have snot dripping from my nose and my eyes are watering, I can just come inside and say, or I can proclaim, it is finished. So, there's that.
For at least the next 48 hours.
Yeah, until
you go outside again.
Yeah, until we go outside again and have to water stuff. And I don't know, but it's that twinkle in Laura's eye when she sees how awesome our garden looks that it makes it all worth it.
Flower garden, vegetable garden, both.
Vegetable. This will be our second year planting vegetables.
Vegetables.
We planted a few flowers in there too.
Don't have any pets? They can ruin nice things like that.
Our snake actually has been very helpful because we put his skin on our garden and keeps the rabbits away.
That's right,
dude.
So that's totally cool. Useful. It is pretty cool. I don't want to brag too much, but yeah, it's pretty cool. So low maintenance pet that also helps with gardening. So
couldn't be any better.
I was trying to think of a really good segue, but I couldn't think of one. I was like, speaking of gardening,
you missed pumpkins. You missed it. You could have been like, great story, like this one,
like this one.
Past favorite. You can put that in later.
I wanted to be like a tale as old as time, but that's like Beauty and the Beast, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, which they're making into a live-action movie.
I know. Now I'm really excited about it.
With Emma Watson.
Oh, is it? I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You totally didn't know that.
What? Emma Watson? Well, that's so weird.
Did you have, like, an Emma Watson diary where you record all the things she's doing?
Maybe.
Maybe. Just maybe. Yeah.
It's called Emma Watson Knows I Exist.com. She doesn't. She shouldn't. That'd be weird. Anyway.
That would be disturbing.
This actually is getting kind of weird. This is the kind of thing that I feel like, if I was more of a, air quotes here, professional, I would probably cut things like that out of the podcast. But, you know, I just respect the listener too much. I want them to hear the whole story.
The uncut.
I want them to hear the video game, the garden, the Emma Watson fanboy, you know, this
creepy Emma Watson.
Creepy, super creepy. The creepiest, really.
Yep. Couldn't be creepier.
So, couldn't be creepier. But I think I might be a fanboy for Emma Watson, but I think Laura might be a fangirl for Lily James.
Okay.
I'm pretty much a fan of every single person in this movie.
Really?
Well, except for maybe the stepsisters. Not that they did a bad job, but, you know, maybe they just did too good a job.
Too good a job.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I would have to agree.
So, normally as a segue into, okay, we're going to talk about the movie now.
Uh-huh.
I would give some type of description of the movie. I would talk about a general plot synopsis that maybe I augmented a little bit from IMDb or...
Or just outright lifted from
Or just outright lifted, allegedly... From IMDb.
Yeah, don't read the one that's halfway down the page, though. That one's terrible.
Poorly written. So that's the thing, though. This is Cinderella. This isn't like a weird, Maleficent, Sleeping Beauty kind of adaptation. This is just a live-action telling of the story of Cinderella.
Well, okay. Of the Disney Cinderella.
Of the Disney Cinderella.
Not the Hans Christian Andersen one.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's missing a bunch of elements.
We apologize to all the Hans Christian purists out there.
And if some of our other friends were here, they'd be telling us not for all the Brothers Grimm purists either.
Oh, Grimm.
Either.
You're right. Sorry, it's not Hans.
Oh, wow.
Well, Hans had his stamp on Cinderella, too. I could not escape that movie when I was a child. I saw that one, to my horrors.
That must have been the one that I watched.
Cinderella was a brunette.
Yep.
I have found her. She's an angel.
Yeah. Aw.
Just couldn't stand the costumes. The set it looked horrendously set-like.
Yeah, but that's like how movies were.
I can tell Laura disagreed because she went to high
octave. It's that one's like a nostalgia thing for me. That's a childhood thing.
True.
I've noticed that with Hollywood or Disney, you know, however you want to name it, their desire to remake, reboot, et cetera, all these franchises or partial ideas or improved upon ideas from my childhood, when I go back and watch the old stuff, I'm surprised at how much it was nostalgia for me. I really thought some of this stuff was better than it really was. And lots of it is nostalgia. And I'm kind of sad about that.
That's a good point. But you know, keep something else in mind, too, about this live-action Cinderella. I feel like this is actually the Cinderella that we've all been waiting for, that we feel like timelessly has always belonged. It always belonged in our world. This is the one that should have always been around because it quintessentially is the masterpiece version of Cinderella. I'm not saying it's perfect. There's no perfect Cinderellas, but it makes sense. It's not just the Disneyification of Cinderella. It's also the quintessential representation as far as I can tell. Wouldn't y'all agree, or did I miss something? Because, like, if someone had told me somehow magically this was the movie that was made in the 1930s, I would have said that makes total sense because it's a masterpiece. It doesn't feel like it was made this year.
Well, what you're saying is that it's always wanted to be part of our world.
Just keep throwing those.
I'm just gonna do Disney yeah. like lines the all night. Like,
have
like
to work in a song with every point.
I'm okay with that. This could be the musical episode. Well, this could be the musical piece of Cinderella that we missed.
Yes,
that we should have gotten.
Yeah. Joe was so excited about this idea.
I've never Joe doing movie by the way. I've never seen you this excited about anything. Well, let me say this though. So, this film was directed by Kenneth Branagh, and for those of you who do not know, kind of like for context, he has a long history of adapting Shakespeare plays. Yeah, he's done Much Ado About Nothing, Henry V, Hamlet, and then he recently, kind of oddly but appropriately, once you see it, he did Thor. Mm-hmm. So he's already dove into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Not the first one, though.
Yeah, the first one.
Oh, I thought it was the most recent one.
No. It's the one where, you know, like, that's why, like, everything's all huge and colorful. And, like, there's these, like, this weird world he's created that, like, the costumes are
it's
crazy.
It's that other Disney movie about a prince becoming king.
Exactly. So he's done a lot of noteworthy things. I mean, most people... You know, not everyone likes his style, but for the most part, he is generally well-respected as a director and has a pretty artistic eye. I would say I was a little hesitant seeing that he was directing this film. One, because I doubted that a live-action Cinderella was really going to be that great. And two, because the last movie that I saw him direct was Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, which was...
The worst movie you've seen all year?
It wasn't the worst movie I saw last year, but it was pretty close.
Wow.
So,
yeah, I was not impressed with that either.
I didn't expect it to be good. Not that we want to get off on a Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit like thread
yeah,
here.
Let's not. There's no musical interlude for that.
There's not. It's like, bang, 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 bang. You know, I thought it would at least be, you know, watchable, mm-hmm. but I was really surprised at how bad it was.
Another feather in his cap is Henry V.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
There's Henry V, Hamlet, and I think he had something else, like A Midnight's Tale, or... I heard
he had something to do with those Narnia movies, but, you know, mm-hmm. those are not the feathers in his cap.
No.
He's kind of hit or miss a little bit. I love him as a Shakespearean actor. There's just nothing like a Kenneth Branagh.
I just happened across that he was some part of Harry Potter in the Chamber of Secrets. It's in his filmography, but he's not director of the film.
No, I think he acted in it. Remember, he was the professor who was all showy and wrote all these books.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that was him.
That is too weird.
I don't remember his name.
Wow. Yes, I know who you mean, though.
Yeah.
You have the internet. I can't look it up. I'm recording.
I have the internet. I'm not looking it up.
It's not worth it.
So we have Disney has gone out and found what should be an appropriate director for this movie, based on his previous work. And they, I think, got a not all-star cast, but they got some really strong actors mm-hmm. in lots of these roles.
That was good enough for me. I didn't need the stars. I just needed the proper performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'll get to this at some point. But I would say that Cate Blanchett, Lily James, Richard Madden, Helena Bonham Carter, and all the other gaggle of people there that I have written down. That I'm not going to list the whole thing, even though I could have. Now that I've
those are the main ones. You mentioned.
But those are the ones that really stand out. And I think...
Except for, what's his name who played the king?
Really? I was going to pick on the guy who played the Grand Duke.
Oh, the Grand Duke was...
Stellan Skarsgård.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying I like the guy who plays the king, but I can't remember his name. He's in a
Derek
lot of stuff.
Jacoby. Derek Jacoby.
Oh, Jacoby. So we have some... I mean, these people typically, except for Cate Blanchett, aren't really leads in a movie. But they, like I said, I think they deliver. So, I think it would be safe to say at this point that to some degree we have all tipped our hand that we enjoyed this and or, Joe...
I hated this movie.
Joe, who's got two palms facing forward,
Joe is already bursting out into song.
That's right. So we know that we enjoyed this film, and or if nothing else, we can say that we were pleasantly surprised by it at minimum.
Yes.
So what I would ask instead of did you enjoy this movie is what about it, not your favorite moment, nothing like that, you know, like we'll get to that towards the end of the show, but what really stuck with you, you know, in this film? Like, was it a message? Was it the acting? Was it, I mean, the costumes, which are noteworthy, the scenery, the effects? Like, what really stuck with you? And normally I would say ladies go first, but we have a hard rule about people over Skype get to go first. So.
Stupid Skypers.
Oh, dear.
So Joe is being a little, you know,
buddy
mean to
here.
Women. Yeah, a little mean to women.
I'm going to be like a stepbrother today.
So, yeah, so Joe, what really stuck with you about this movie?
Honestly, it was just like the faithfulness to an innocent portrayal, like an honest portrayal of all these fairy tale personalities. It seemed like the only one that stuck out that was kind of perhaps portraying the fairy tale persona of characters was Stellan Skarsgård as the Grand Duke. And so what I mean is, like, everybody else had this like childlike innocence to their faithful performance. They were completely real and seriously taking the story as like real to life. So when it must have said in the script, now the Prince Kit now falls head over heels for Cinderella, you feel like the actor reined that in so hard, so honestly, so committedly that his eyes started, you know, getting glassy, and you know he had wells of tears in his eyes just because in the performance it was like called for. You love this creature, and you have never experienced love before in your life.
I saw a legitimate twinkle.
Yes,
oh,
and,
yeah.
And that struck me about all the people in this movie.
So, can you elaborate a little bit on that, or a little bit more on that kind of like childlike wonder?
Yes, at the very beginning, Cinderella has a very sweet conversation with her dear mother before she passes away. They're having a great day in the middle of the afternoon on their lovely Thomas Kincaidian farmhouse land.
Freshly painted.
Yes, exactly. They're out in the tall grass picking flowers and running around with the mice and whatever there is. And you see the servants out in the distance taking care of, you know, this and that, and, you know, shuffling hay or whatever. And the father is coming in from his merchant's work. And a question that Cinderella's mother asks her, Ella's mother, sorry, asks, you still talking to the mice or something to that effect? You're still committed to that? You still believe that the you can understand what the mice are saying? And Cinderella, whatever. The girl is like, oh, yes, I can totally understand what they're saying. Do you think that I can, Mom? And she's like, oh, I believe in everything. You know, it's not only possible, but it has to be true. And there's this... not just ultra heady sweetness, but like a faithfulness to, like, I believe in everything. And it was really condensed into these few lines at the very beginning of the movie that sort of like one of the running themes is, you know, always be courageous and kind. But in that very beginning, it's like they had to establish, you know, we know that the audience, the cynical modern audience, would frown upon such an idealistic, you know, ambitious message. So we're going to establish right here at the beginning, we're going to shrug all of that off. We are totally embracing the idealistic message, and everything about this is going to be the ideal. Does that make any sense? Like, they were really sold on this commitment to, like, pure joyful innocence and commitment to something as a whole, you know, 100%. Everything that they believed in was there.
Yeah, it's like the filmmakers said, haters gonna hate, but then they just decided to shake it off.
Yeah, yeah.
So
shaking it all off.
That's right.
Gosh, this is awful.
This is gonna keep
happening. This is already awful.
Sorry. And you're a part of it.
No. I'm a part of it.
No, like I said, I think, and that's one of the things that, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into just a little bit, but it definitely struck me as odd that someone would commit, especially in a live action telling of this movie, when it seems like it would be so easy to make real equal, like, gritty or, you know, flawed hero, mm-hmm. or, you know, like, things not as perfect, you know? Like,
and this is what I loved about the film.
Yeah, it's so easy.
I love that it didn't have to be gritty.
Exactly. So, okay, so, Laura, go with that. What was it about it?
Man, they just totally, they committed to a tone, mm-hmm. and they didn't budge at all. And that was incredible, because I think that it would be really easy to feel insecure about presenting this kind of pure, joyful world, mm-hmm. and say, oh, well, you know, for all the cynical people, we have to throw in, like, yeah, but this villain, she has this crazy backstory, and, mm-hmm. like, she's mean for a reason, or, I don't know, it just felt like it would have been really easy to shift your tone to try to be everything to everyone, mm-hmm. but it was actually the total, complete commitment to that sweet, anything is possible kind of tone that, I mean, I think just made it incredible. And I was so appreciative of that. And I think that, you know, I almost want to say that tone maybe started with the mice. Mm-hmm. You know, like, when you look at this story and you look at the talking animals and the scene where the pumpkin turns into the carriage and you've got a goose that's a, you know, a driver. When you look at that and you try to think about how you're going to interpret that into a live action, I think that's when you decide, what is this going to sound like? You know?
Yeah.
Because that, if this had tried for any other tone, that whole scene would have been just ridiculous, mm-hmm. and eye rolling. But it was so sweet and perfect and funny. And anyway, I just felt like that whole magical anything is possible kind of tone is where it began, and it just everything revolved around that, and it became completely believable because everybody in the film was saying, this is real, this is possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the performances, the costumes were otherworldly, everything lended itself to that magical sense, and it totally sucked me in. I love this movie so much. I can't even conjure up shame. It's just there.
I know exactly what you mean. it's weird, right? Because after the Snow White movie that Disney made a few years ago. What was it called?
Snow White and the Huntsman?
I never did see Mirror Mirror, but there were two back to back.
I'm pretty sure it was Mirror Mirror, but I'm not positive. And it was just, you know, one of these revisionist style fairy tales where it seemed to be going for the novelty, going for how can we shake things up? How can we modernize it? How can a Snow White feel like she popped out of the modern day world into a fairy tale world where she behaves and acts like a modern human being, but set in a medieval era? Mm-hmm. And how everything in that film kind of struck me that way. Like, it was like play acting. But it was the way that everybody was in that movie. And they did things that were, you know, breaking the rules of, like, good fairy tales. I mean, like, I know you want to be original and creative, but that was a movie that demonstrated where originality and creativity is not everything that it's cracked up to be when you ruin something that was already good in the first place. Mm. And that was a Disney product as well. So I'm hoping that maybe in 10, 15 years' time, they decide to go back and give us the Snow White that would be the companion to this one and the Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I hope that. Do we know who's on Beauty and the Beast yet?
Who's making it?
Yeah.
Director?
Who's the director?
I heard something about it, but the name did not ring a bell for me.
Gotcha.
So Joe's job is to look it up on IMDb. Because it's got to be out there, because I know they're pre-production, if not production. Or filming. So this tone that we've kind of honed in on, I think it would be easy to say and fair to say that tone is reinforced by what most people are going to walk away from this film with. And that's the have courage and be kind.
Oh, yeah. If they didn't get that message, then they're kind of deaf.
So, but that in and of itself is probably one of the reasons why, like I said, they kind of keep to this tone. It's not only magical and it's not only kind of innocent, but it almost takes a movie with that tone to get away with throwing out something as simple as mm-hmm. have courage and be kind and you know, and making that successful. But what in a lot of reviews and a lot of criticisms of the film, even if people enjoyed the film, like some of the like kind of backhanded compliments or people, or I guess people who just didn't like the film for whatever reason, their criticisms was this concept of having courage and being kind. It actually supports abuse. Like they wanted to see Cinderella stand up for herself at some mm-hmm. point. They wanted to see her, I guess, fight back, kind of overcome through ways that are empowering, or that people would consider empowering. And I think that I don't agree with that, but I would love to hear before I get off on some type of, oh, look, Fizz is going to talk for a half an hour kind of rant about it. I would love to know how you would respond to Cinderella being a weak character or an unempowered character because she's basically allowing abuse.
She actually is one of the strongest female characters I think I've seen on screen in a while. And, like, here's where I would start with that. She does not allow her happiness or her sense of the world to be dictated by people around her and mm-hmm. how they treat her. She is completely in control of her choices of... I mean, nobody is... Nobody has control of her mind or her heart, even if they have some control maybe of her body. And so that, to me, is... I never looked at her and thought she's letting people walk all over her. And another reason why I feel like she's really strong is that for somebody like this character who is just, like... You could think of her as kind of sickly sweet, like sticky sweet. She's always kind all the time. Mm. You could roll your eyes at that. But I feel like she actually... If you think of her that way, you're not really looking at her character, because she's not one-dimensional. She actually, even though she is decidedly kind to those who are cruel to her, she doesn't let their cruelty roll off her back. She feels it, and there are several scenes in which it really gets to her, and she's crying and mourning that, and mourning the loss that she's experienced. And she also doesn't ignore the truth of a situation and tell herself lies to get through it.
Right.
She actually tells herself truths to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, those are some of the reasons why I would say that I completely disagree with this concept that she is, you know, she's a doormat.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also have to play up the perspective of a Christian worldview that in leadership, you take a servant spirit and you literally serve others around you. You love your enemies, and that is how you heap coals of fire on them. We see this happen, whether intentionally or unintentionally so, when Cinderella has been incredibly above and beyond kind to the stepmother and the stepsisters when they didn't deserve it. And when she officially is on her way to leave the house and become full-fledged royalty, she has every power to, you know, carry out some vengeance on these wicked people that have been terribly cruel to her. She clearly acknowledges the fact that they are guilty when she walks out on her stepmother and says, "You are not my mother."
Mm-hmm.
But then a moment later, she pronounces that, "I forgive you." And that was in her power. That was in her control. That was her saying, "This is what I stand for. This is my position. You don't have control of who I am on the inside. I served you because I wanted to basically follow the wishes of my real mother." you know, to be mm-hmm. kind and courageous. Something that my sister pointed out that really struck her as special about this message is that to be kind like this, it actually takes a heck of a lot of courage. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the movie doesn't, I don't think it conveys it very well, where the courage comes in. We see the kindness all throughout the movie. That's abundantly clear. But remember how, I guess you see demonstrations of where there are many instances where they could have gotten vengeful, they could have become bitter, they could have become cynical. And basically, the moment you choose to not be kind because you do not have the courage to be kind, what happens next? Well, you become cynical, you start tooting your own horn, you start complaining, mm-hmm. you sound like a mm-hmm. whiner and a complainer, you sound like you're not going to get anywhere in life because woe is you, and you start fending for your own in a negative way.
You pretty much become Lady Tremaine. Become the stepmother.
Thank you. That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm talking about. Because the Lady Tremaine at one point in the story, it says, my story was just like yours. This mm-hmm. is who I was, and my story is just like yours. Up to a point, but then when things went bad for me, I decided to become nasty. Mm-hmm. And then you understand, well, thank God Cinderella's not like you.
mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like both you guys' perspective on it, because I think we're all kind of on the same page here. While I agree with you, Joe, that I don't think they did a great job necessarily of showing that it takes a lot of like strength and, I guess, empowerment, since that's the word we're kind of throwing around.
That was probably better demonstrated through Prince Kit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So since we didn't get that, like, well, and I think we get it to some degree because we're talking about it and we understand it.
Yeah.
But I don't think the movie took the time to really make it a point. I think that it almost seems like people who have this criticism of her basically being a doormat, it's easier for them to see that. Mm-hmm. But in the end, like both you guys have pointed out, it's easier to fight back. Mm-hmm. It's easier to not be kind.
Yeah. It's easier to defend yourself and to think, whatever scrap of respect I can fight for, that's all I have.
Mm-hmm.
But her perspective, well, basically the way Cinderella is living is that there's a bigger picture where even if you don't get justice for yourself, justice will be given. And there will be wholeness and happiness, even though it doesn't look like it right now. It's mm-hmm. just a broader perspective than saying, this is all I have, so I'm going to fight for every inch of it. And I have to fight it for myself because there's no one that's coming to get me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I feel like it's a much braver, broader perspective to live the way that she was living.
And I think there was a couple of the reviews that we'll link in the show notes who really started talking about this, and they either talked about what Joe mentioned, how if we look at this from a Christian perspective, especially when it comes to confronting evil, we're encouraged to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to be kind, but to be kind to those who do evil to us. Not that just we know about our evil, but people who are actually harming us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a difference between doing kind to those who do evil and accepting abuse.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Laura, you know, you're touching on this too. Like, she's always in control. She's not, you know, telling herself platitudes to continue abuse.
She's not doing it under, like, fear. She isn't mm-hmm. cowering under the tyranny of the sisters and mother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so if she fights back, what she's using, something that Josh Larson at Think Christian talks about, you know, the use of vengeance. She's not using vengeance against her stepmother and stepsisters. She's using kindness and forgiveness. And when you do that, what you do, instead of using vengeance to just hold on or separate yourself, you know, like, I'm using this vengeance to back you off
mm-hmm.
and cut out a little piece of territory for myself. you stay over there, I'll stay over here, we'll butt heads, but we're both, you know, we're fighting for this territory.
Mm-hmm. Can I extract a really awesome Bible verse from one of the reviews that we read?
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. You can edit this out if you don't like the Bible.
if you don't like the Bible, dang.
Okay, so this kind of thing says it really well, what you're hitting on there, Fizz. It was 1 Peter 3:3-5. This is the NIV, which is good enough for me for this purpose. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to adorn themselves. Isn't that captured in a way in this movie?
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that's part of the reason that, like, some people think that the strict, basically, retelling of Cinderella still comes off as, you know, slightly misogynistic. You know, you need to have a quiet spirit. You need to hope for your prince. Mm-hmm. And while I think a greater reading of Peter would not make that verse sound as simple or rejecting, given I'm a man, so it's not really, you know, affecting me. Mm-hmm. But I think that adds to it. And I think that quiet spirit is kind of, like I said, it's what works with Romans. You know, you're not just, like I said, you're not fighting for your piece of territory. You're overcoming evil.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not coexisting with evil because you're using vengeance or using, you know, physical violence to just beat them back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like this concept that I keep trying to evangelize to people about, you know, love, or true love, or honest love, being the only thing that can change someone's heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you point a gun at someone, or when you beat someone up, or when you threaten someone with violence, typically what you do is you change their behavior. You don't change their heart. There's a fear of consequence, not a joy of serving, or a joy of submission.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know, like in a marriage, if Laura beat me, then I would not want to step out of line because she's so physically violent to me. But I wouldn't be submitting to her because I want what's best for her. I'm submitting out of her fear.
Mm-hmm.
But if she loved me in the best way that she knew how, then I would submit to her because of her great love for me. I would actually have a changed heart, mm-hmm. and my actions would follow. So it really depends on what you want. Do you want someone to change their actions temporarily?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want someone's heart to change, and then the actions of love and the response of love to flow out of that, and actions being changed permanently?
Well, and even if you're, so let's say, okay, that's one perspective to say, like,
oh,
look,
that's
at,
the perspective.
To say, look at what you're.
Mic drop. Sorry.
or even just one side of it, to say, okay, look at how you're treating other people. You know, what do you want from this interaction? Or if you're thinking about others at all, if you are looking at it from a purely self-focused point of view, I like what you were saying about the fact that you can either fight for to cut your piece of territory out of what everybody else is scrapping over,
mm-hmm.
or you can be totally other, which is what I'm saying about the larger perspective. She could have, you know, fought for the stepmother's affection, or fought for nice clothes or a place in the house.
Conformity.
A room in the house.
That would have been conformity.
Yeah, but instead, so if she did, maybe she would have gotten. Maybe she would have achieved something if she fought really hard for it.
And she would have become the product of the stepmother in those actions.
And we've seen what all of those women in that house have, and none of them are happy.
Mm.
But she, Cinderella, she is not fighting over that piece of territory. She's actually living into the broader, more beautiful world around them, the non-material world. And so she is the better off of all of them. And you can see that in their portrayal in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
she has, the whole world is hers. And even, you know, one part that really struck me is when she says that she resigns herself, locked in the attic, she resigns herself that she will never see the prince again, or the apprentice, or whatever she calls him. But she just kind of logs it away with all those beautiful memories from her childhood. She knows that it will always be with her. That happiness will always be with her. And she's dancing around the attic. And that, to me, is not ignorance. It's not taking yourself out of the world. But it seemed pretty clearly to me that she was fully living into the beauty of the world around her. She was just choosing to live into what was beautiful and not what was not beautiful. Yeah.
Can we also say that this is a conundrum for any telling of Cinderella? Like, this isn't unique to Disney's telling in the live-action version. If you, this is your complaint for this movie in 2015, then what you're saying is, well, I guess we can't have any more princess movies in, you know, that are based on classic fairy tales, because here we go again, bringing up some archaic traditionalism. You know, and that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think that the best response to the hypocrites is just get over them. Like, you can't listen to these critics too long, because they're taking the fairy tale out of context. They're thinking about it in the wrong light. You know, we know, in a manner of speaking, that this story doesn't hold up to real worldism. You know, it's like, it's not a picture perfect, fully fledged worldview matched to our own. Like, you know, it's heavy dependence on magic. Anyone who believes in Disney magic is kind of off their rocker. And this movie makes the point that the magic is essentially your deity in the story.
When there is kindness, there is goodness. When there is goodness, there is magic.
Oh, yeah. I like your segue there. You want to talk about that?
I do now.
keep going with that thought, Joe, because... Yeah, this is definitely, you know, if we're going to equate this with Christian values or a Christian perspective, I mean, who's the fairy godmother who comes and answers your prayers, you know?
She's actually our hairy dog father. I have to say that the thing about Disney is that they use an amalgamation of different belief systems, and this is a great example of that, where you get the Christianism, but you also get the humanism, and you get it all. That, like, going back to Mother Ella, she was saying at the beginning of the film that she believes in everything, and you just get the impression very quickly, like, that was a statement about her worldview, and she went to the grave with that worldview. So it was pretty interesting to me, though, that when you deconstruct storytelling, it's usually the worldviews in Act 1 and Act 2 that they're breaking down, deconstructing, and they're proving to be not altogether true and effective in the long run. It won't really pay off. If you try to commit to one of those espoused worldviews up to the climax, then it probably isn't one that would work. It's when the heroes have to face off with the antagonist at the very end of the climax that something rings true, that it works then that didn't work in the past. So if you think about it, go back to Ella's father. He seems to be a French man who is very much a traditional French man, who's also a very loving father and husband. But he gets derailed when his wife passes away. And the narrator, the hairy dog father, tells us so. She points out that he was just not the same man after his wife passes away. So he's, like, distracted while Ella is concentrated on living in the moment and enjoying a good book. And she wants to be there for her father. And he leans in and says, you know, Ella, here, I'm wondering, do you think that I have another chance to be happy? Is it possible that I can believe again in anything is possible? Can I have that kind of idealism like your mother again? I want to believe that anything can happen again. And it's kind of like a deconstruction of one element of the Disney worldview, if you think about it, because what he is saying is, you know, when you wish upon a star, doesn't matter who you are, I want to believe that I can get married again, too, and be happy, and blah, 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 blah.
So he slipped into Kermit. Yeah, like, Kermit.
This is all the Disney properties wrapped into one.
And dependent on a partner, too, if I find my special someone.
Yeah. So what's funny is that he was just like sold in this idea, like, why can't I be happy in everything that I do? I should be able to be happy in anything, any kind of situation. And Cinderella, falling back on her mother's beliefs as well at this early stage of the story, understands, well, yeah, I know where dad is coming from. He's thinking like mom did. And so then they go out on that limb to say, yeah, let's bring Lady Tremaine into the home, and you know, let's unite these families. But obviously that turned out to not be such a good idea and kind of immature of them. And so it proves very quickly, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Maybe that wasn't such a good thing to live our lives by.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and as a man, I would say that was one of my biggest problems with this film. This stereotype that a man has to have a wife to be happy.
Oh,
you know, like they can't have security without a woman, you know. Like, where are all the independent men in this film?
You're too far away for me to slap.
Oh,
equality, dude.
I know, for real. It goes both ways.
What happened to equal treatment?
No, I'm sorry, Joe. Continue.
You know, it kind of was an eye-opener moment for Ella's father and for herself. A few moments later, they're kind of reflecting on those choices and realize they have to live with their mistakes with gentility and still respond cordially to the stepmother and sisters. And so they're going to have the right heart attitude, you know, going forward. But you still get the impression that they're working out, what do we do now? What do we believe in? Yeah. And then Cinderella, you know, just sticks to her values. In the long run, it all works out. But, you know, it seems like Mother Ella was more of the universalist. Father Ella was more of the traditional French man who was the romanticist. And that is a worldview. That is a thing that has been used in many a movie. And romanticism goes back into the Victorian era? And it was kind of espoused in movies like The Titanic, you know, where it all boils down to a particular version of love. And it seems like he kind of fell into that particular perspective. Then Cinderella, however, even though she doesn't really, like, describe mindfully where she's coming from and why she believes in these things, she essentially has a foundation of Judeo-Christian ethics. And it isn't abundantly clear until the climax of the movie, when they decide upon what worldview is right. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point that she identifies concept of true justice and true mercy. And that was pretty potent. That was one of the reasons why this movie was such a shocker for me when she says, "I forgive you."
That's interesting, too. Actually, I read that is part of the original story, which I didn't realize, was that she forgives her stepmother.
That's awesome.
Just in keeping with your observation about the kind of debunking the parents' worldview, she is sustained by that for a while. You know, she keeps saying, just have courage and be kind. It's interesting that at her most broken moment, when all of her, you know, her last hope basically is ripped to shreds on the staircase, she requires somebody else's intervention is required for her to move forward. You know, she isn't able to just pull herself up by her bootstraps and say, that's okay, I'll get over it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else intervenes.
Well, and that's kind of where I wanted to go with it, because to me, when her mother throws out there that, you know, there's kindness, where there's kindness, there's goodness, where there's goodness, there's magic.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of implies, and what the movie implies, especially if you take what you're saying, Joe, and say that ultimately Cinderella ends up with a kind of Judeo-Christian outlook on life, because where it's problematic is the fact that I don't think that what didn't sit with me is having courage and being kind. I'm like, that's not enough.
Yeah. You're right. It's not enough.
Like, okay, Cinderella lives happily ever after, but Laura, you've already mentioned two things that I think, you know, I wanted to kind of hit on. One is that it wasn't just, you know, having courage and being kind. It was that she was able to, one, find the joy in life, even if it was in the margins of life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which I think a lot of us have trouble doing.
But not us podcasters.
Not us podcasters. I mean, everything goes great for us. The second thing is that it took something or someone else to intervene when things got too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, like if I had to criticize, I would say that in this case, you know, the Harry Dogfather shows up and, you know, makes everything great.
Mm-hmm.
And from a Christian perspective, like, God doesn't show up and give us a chair, you know. Well, I mean, I guess if you listen to Joel Osteen, he will show up and he will give you, you know, you know, and you get a car and you get a car and, you know, but that's not what we believe. We don't mm-hmm. believe that the comfort that God gives or the comfort that we can find in God isn't going to be a new dress and tickets to the prom.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I don't think that that's a problem reflecting shallow, worldly-minded Christianity. I think that that's a flaw of the Disney worldview.
Well, I do too. And I feel like they're completely right and they're completely wrong. And I think it, like I said, I think it starts where Laura already started. It takes someone else intervening. Mm-hmm. So they're completely right. Cinderella can't do it on her own.
And even if you, okay, look beyond the fairy godmother. Cinderella will be right back where she started at the end of the film if it wasn't for a community, we could say a community that was looking out for her, meaning the prince and his companion.
His captain.
They intervened in that case. And so whether you want to call it magic or community, that it takes other people stepping into our lives or something else beyond that. And I mean, you know, if we try to take this story as an allegory for Christianity, it's going to fall to pieces in a million places. But yep. It's just, there are just some interesting places where I could see, as a Christian, I could see truths about my faith being played out. And honestly, as a fairy tale, I feel like the story of the gospel is intrinsically at the heart of this story. And that's why I feel like fairy tales like this can have impact without having to be gritty and over explaining.
Yeah.
Because essentially, in the end, there's this story, which is, in my belief system, is the first story that was ever told, which is that there's a heroine or a hero who's in great need, and then there's, or a damsel in distress, I guess you would call them, and then there's somebody who comes after us to save us because we can't save ourselves, and they pursue us relentlessly
mm-hmm.
until they rescue us from the big bad, whatever. And there is something that is the big bad, and, you know, it may have a backstory, but it's just bad. It's cruel, and it gets its comeuppance in the end, you know,
mm-hmm.
Evil is defeated. So I feel like because they chose to be pure to the fairy tale sense, that story that we identify with at the core, it was intact. And so I feel like that's where a lot of the impact comes from, even if some of the fringe parts of the story don't fit into the Christian perspective perfectly. Does that make sense?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Can I touch upon a really cool aspect of that?
Mm-hmm.
Would it matter if I said no?
Nope, because this is from the Bible. You've already admitted that you'll accept it.
You don't like scripture, Mikey, but Joe's going to bring
Apparently
it.
Apparently I don't.
All right, so the thought occurred to me that there's the face-off between Ella and the stepmother in the attic, and they're getting pretty snipey at each other. And it's the only time that Cinderella seems to, like, lose her cool, express some anger, but also, like, restrain herself with every word that she's very careful to choose her words. What's interesting is that it's so compelling how Ella is controlling herself that it even seems to influence the stepmother to try and control her words as well, because she realizes she's losing the argument. So she ends up basically copying Ella's approach, because this is what you do. Anyway, okay, but that's going into psychological mumbo-jumbo. All right, so the point is here that so matter-of-factly, the lady Tremaine says, this is how we're going to do this. You're going to get into the castle. You're going to marry the prince. Then you're going to put me as Lord of the Household, and then I'm going to tell everybody what to do. I'm going to put the prince in his place. My daughters are going to get married off, to beneficial connections, And then from this point on, everything will go according to my plan. And did I happen to mention my cat's name is Lucifer?
I just want to throw that in there.
But then to counter the wicked stepmother, Cinderella says very quickly, "No, I will forfeit my entire relationship with Prince Kit to stop you from taking over the kingdom. I will not play along with you. I will not become the hypocrite. I will not, get that low for you and do
Again,
what you
great
want.
Great personal strength.
Yes, yeah. I will sacrifice my life and my vision for the betterment of Kit and his kingdom." And that's pretty cool, if you mm-hmm. think about it. Like, if you're splitting hairs, she's forfeiting her life for Kit's kingdom. She's laying down her life for his. She realizes, apart from this relationship with Kit, she's got nothing going for her. Mm-hmm. And if she doesn't cooperate with the stepmother at this point, then life is really bleak.
Yeah, there's no promises of anything after that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, again, another example where Cinderella didn't have a reason to believe that everything was going to turn out rosy. She sacrificed everything, just thinking that's the right thing that she had to do. And again, that was another example of what would Christ have wanted us to do, And that was kind of demonstrated by this character development.
Well, having basically dropped a gospel bomb and then doubled down on the gospel bomb, I think I'm going to slide us into our wrap-up. Because I know there's still going to be other things that we've mentioned, so I want to leave plenty of time to do that. So, obviously, and I've already said this, so I'll say it again, because it's my show. We obviously all like this movie. Some of us to singing degrees, and some of us just to high admiration. But was there anything that you didn't like, made you say, come on, or you wish they had done differently? Joe?
No, I was going to defer to Laura. I'm Skyper. I already got my first turn.
How chivalrous of you.
Quite.
Okay, so I did not like the painter guy. And it wasn't even that he took... I mean, I guess he did kind of take me out of the story. And I'm not even sure why. Maybe because it was kind of like... I could see that he was supposed to be the comic relief, but there were already so many comedic moments that it wasn't really necessary for him to be in there over the top. You know what I'm saying?
I felt like he was doing an impression of someone and I couldn't figure out who it was.
Yeah,
of
I was a, like, am painter. I... Am I like...
A painter.
Yeah. I kind of felt like, as I was watching him, I was like, wait, am I supposed to know who this is? Is this some
right.
kind of, like, comedian that I'm
Didn't
supposed to be?
Didn't feel like it
be?
Was his proper introduction.
No. And then he never showed up again, so that was something that I could totally have done without. And, honestly, the forgiveness scene jarred me a little bit. I wish that it was, I'm glad it was in there, but I wish it was done, maybe it could have been done in a different way, I don't know. But it kind of felt like being staged in that way where she is headed out the door with everything she's ever dreamed of, it's kind of like, it'd be kind of easy to look back and say, I forgive you in that moment.
Interesting.
The real, that's just kind of where it lost its teeth to me, that there were moments when clearly Ella had the opportunity to just go for the throat, and she chose not to. And maybe the forgiveness scene would have been better in one of those moments where, forgiveness is really portrayed like what it is, which is that when you forgive somebody, you're taking on the pain yourself. You're not making them feel the pain of or the consequences of their decision. You're taking it on yourself.
That's an interesting concept there. If it were possible, it would have been mighty powerful if there was a way for Cinderella to forgive the stepsisters and mother when they were leaving for the ball without her. And she was left there in the cold at night to, like, just grieve the fact that she wasn't going. That would have been the most potent moment to find a dramatic way to let her forgive them.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like it could have been done. Maybe Ella needed her moment of breakdown there since she hadn't experienced one before, where, you know, she actually let the pain of life get to her for a moment. But I agree that it could have been more powerful if it was done in a situation where you couldn't, basically you couldn't say, well, it's easy for you to do that now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying. But I am glad that it was in there.
That's all I'm saying.
All right, the end.
Okay, I am a Skyper, so now I'll take my turn before Fizz.
I'm fine with that.
I thought that the come on moment was, there's like a runner up and there's another one. So I'll tell you what the runner up moment was. When Prince Kit is, showing Cinderella around the palace and he says, oh, let me show you something that no one has ever seen before. Here is my secret garden. I was like,
it's a metaphor.
What? Are you kidding me? That was hard. That was very difficult to accept.
Why would a grown man have a garden with a swing in it?
Oh, come on, you stereotyping.
I mean, like,
jerk.
Okay, wait a minute. He said that no one had ever been in there before. I mean, what?
It looked awfully trim. Those hedges looked awfully trim for no one being in there.
He has a tree swing. For himself? Alone?
Yep. For his thoughts, man. Him and his thoughts.
Okay, that was the runner-up. The real come-on moment was when the pumpkin turned back into organic products, and it, like, careens down the dirt road and starts to bounce, roll, tumble with Cinderella on the inside while it's shrinking down to its original size. And everything just smashes to bits and vanishes in the thin air. And somehow Cinderella got out of there without a scrape. I was like, okay, that is the one sensational moment that was really in there just for the 8-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of
killed me.
I'm
down with the magic, but this is too much.
Yes.
That's where Joe draws the line.
Yep.
Well, I think you took mine, Joe.
Which one?
I think the prince going to his secret garden was just. I did a literal eye roll.
We watched this movie twice, and the second time we went with our friend Griffin, who's been on the podcast a lot, and he guffawed in the middle of the theater. Oh, that whole scene! He was just over there laughing and smirking.
Yeah, it was pretty great. I just was like, really? I'm like. I know it's a fairy tale, and I know they did a really good job of making Kit a really likable prince.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not someone you like because he's super attractive, even though he is.
Those eyes, man.
Same goes for Lily James. Same thing. Really likable people who also happen to be very easy on the eyes.
Yeah, so,
and you believe that they like each other because they see the world the same way. That was made very clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but also that Kit was coming into that worldview thanks to Cinderella's, great conveyance of her perspective. Her
passion.
Yeah.
Like you get the impression while they were out there hunting that day in the woods, like. He was just an empty vessel waiting for the right perspective to come along. And he knew that he didn't 100% agree with the Grand Duke and his father about some things. And things just didn't quite make sense until he got an outside input.
Yeah, it was like, she gave him the vocabulary to voice what he felt about the way he saw the world.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Well, is everyone done now? Can I finish talking about how much I hated this part of the movie?
Yes, please. Continue.
Guess so.
You guys. So we all love Kit because he was easy on the heart and the eyes. But to believe a prince had a super secret, maybe even sexy secret garden with a nice
swing.
Where
he swing, puts the ladies' shoes back
where
on.
He's never, never entertained any ladies.
I like to imagine he's like, no one's ever been here before, and then he like, there's like a woman's handkerchief on the edge, and he like sticks it in his pocket. He's like, no one, I promise.
No.
No one.
Must have been my mom's. Yeah, so I you know, I was like, I can deal with, you know, magic, but an attractive prince who's never tried to get down before? Come on. I'm suspending disbelief.
They were both supposed to be pretty young, though.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, like I said, my come on moment is kind of...
I'm trying to debunk your come on
moment. Yeah, it's like silly, and I totally recognize that. Because for the most part, even though like I didn't think that this was the greatest movie I've ever seen, I thought almost everything was pretty well done, and I didn't really have a lot of things to nitpick against. So that was the best one I could come up with.
Gotcha.
So moving on to favorite moments. Are y'all going to like, if I don't pick my wife, then I didn't pick my wife.
Why don't you go first, Mikey?
I don't go first. It's not my thing.
Well, two votes.
What if we're telling you go first?
It's not my bag, baby.
I second her motion.
Hey, you stop doing things to my wife's motion. Hey, you.
I'll go first. I want to say all the things I love.
Okay, well then quickly say all the things you love.
Oh, quickly.
Well, ish.
There were actually several moments where I teared up.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was when Kit cuddles up next to his dad when he's dying. I mean, it was just such a tender moment to me. I really believe that they had a special relationship and that there was genuine love there. And anyway, that made me just feel really... I was really grateful that they were willing to portray a prince who stereotypically in a Disney movie is very one-dimensional and only is about his looks and can fight with a sword or whatever. Anyway, he was just a very tender character. I also really loved the message. It was kind of subtle, but there were several parts where this message came out about identity. And about how easy it is for us to believe that we are what people say that we are.
Hmm.
And it was subtle enough that it had an impact on me, but it didn't steal the show. Like it didn't feel like a conflicting theme with anything else that was happening.
Right.
But two scenes that really were powerful to me along that, you know, in that theme were when they call her Cinderella for the first time. And there's a line where it says that, you know, she's looking at herself and in that tea kettle or whatever. And it says that she could almost believe that she was what they said that she was, which is merely a creature of toil and ash. And so that to me was so well done. I really believed that how difficult it would be under that kind of abuse, verbal and physical abuse every day, and not believe that that's all I am. And then, you know, that comes full circle at the very end when she's coming down the stairs and she looks at herself in the mirror. And I didn't write down this quote, but the narrator is saying that one of the most vulnerable things we'll do is to basically be before someone and say, this is what I am. Will you accept me for mm-hmm. what I am? And, man, what a powerful message in a culture when basically all the celebrities, all the characters on screen are saying, you aren't good enough how you are. You need to be like me. You need to look like me. And, I thought that was so powerful and so well done. And, it really spoke to me, I guess, maybe more than as a woman, as a human being, saying that it's easy to believe that I am only what people call me, but God says I see exactly who you are and I accept exactly who you are. So that was really powerful to me.
So follow that up, Joe.
Okay, I'm gonna try. two things that I've really enjoyed. Yeah, that haven't come up already. The question has been raised by many of the critics and reviewers: how come the Harry Godfather, the dog mother, whatever, didn't intervene on Cinderella's behalf in better ways sooner? you know, if she has all these powers, why couldn't she just help Cinderella along and make it easier for her? And there's two pretty interesting details here. I can't say that you can draw conclusions about, but they are pretty clever. We've already talked about how Cinderella has this special fragility to her, but she's going to work really hard at maintaining herself, and she's going to be true to that and maintain those convictions and what makes her unique and not conform to this world. And even when that means being abused and serving people who are your enemies, it's interesting to note that they used butterflies on her her godmother dress, because, well, what did butterflies do? They're caterpillars. We went through metamorphosis. Couldn't have been easy. Couldn't have been simple. But they're not just a symbol of beauty on the other side when they become butterflies. It's a transformation thing. It's a new being. It's a new creation. It's really something else. There's that little detail. I think that it's interesting how there's sort of like a metaphor there. I haven't exactly put into the right words, but there's something going on there where they kind of see this as Cinderella's metamorphosis story. And there's a connection there between her and the butterflies. Then there is another detail that I really appreciated, going back to the question of why didn't the godmother intervene on her behalf better? And if you recall, the narrator was the godmother all along. And at one point when she was face-to-face with Cinderella, she pointed out that she remembered something that Ella's mother had said many years ago. And Ella was like, wait a minute, how do you know what she said? You weren't there for that. So there's this omnipresence kind of thing going on with the godmother, which seems to imply she also has foreknowledge of what's going to happen around the corner. So when there is the scene where Cinderella jumps on horseback and rushes off in her grief right after she has been called Cinderella, and it's broken her heart, and she's despondent. And that's when she meets the prince, and the godmother says, if it weren't for the fact that the stepmother and sisters were so evil to her, Cinderella probably would have never met the prince. And then there's also a similar sort of like, if the divine had interfered on, you know, on Cinderella's behalf, it would have ruined everything kind of moment late in the film, when the Grand Duke and all of his men have gone to the house and got that glass slipper and tried to fit it on the stepsister's feet, and it didn't work, and they're about to leave because they're done here and they're going to leave. And it's all thanks to the mice that they opened the window that they're able to hear Cinderella singing. And it's just like barely there, and all of them can hear it. And it's just, it's more than coincidence that because of who Cinderella is, she is singing at a time when most people in their right mind, depressed mind, who are not willing and able to overcome evil with good, would not be singing up in the top of the attic like Cinderella is. And the prince and all of his men hear that and know something is very wrong here. But they're all incredibly gracious with Lady Tremaine and get Cinderella down from the attic. And there's that special moment again where, like, the godmother had to have known that that was going to happen. Had she intervened on Cinderella's behalf in some other way, like popping up in the attic and saying, here, Cinderella, I'll use my magic wand to unlock the door for you. Zing! Okay, you can go downstairs and tell everybody you're here. You know, that it would have just ruined things. It would not have been as unique and important had that happened.
Well, and she is what she is because of her experiences and how she's grown through them and chosen to deal with them. She is who the prince loves because of her experiences.
That's it. We've left you with nothing, Fizz.
Yeah.
I like the mice.
Her dress was pretty.
And the dresses.
Or, like, if you were my daughter, which she saw with me, and we were driving home, she's like, "Daddy, I like the girl." And I'm like, "Oh, dear. What girl, honey?" She's like, "I'm talking about the one in not Cinderella. No, the other girl." Like, which one, honey? We narrowed it down. The one that she liked was Anastasia.
Oh, is that her mother?
No,
no,
that
no,
was
no,
the,
it's one of the sisters.
Awesome.
Yeah.
This is the same daughter that tells the stories?
Yes.
You got problems, Joe. Mm-hmm. You got problems. We'll be praying for you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I mean, honestly, we've hit on a lot of the things that that really stood out to me that I really liked about this movie. The thing that I was going to mention above most things, we did spend a good amount of time on during my come on moment, which was that the Prince and Cinderella's relationship was based as much as possible mm-hmm. on something more than just how pretty each of them are. Yeah. Though, again,
that didn't hurt nothing.
They also are very pretty, especially Mr. Prince Charming. And that ice cold gaze of love. You know, there's those other shots of just his, like, piercing blue eyes.
Winter is here, baby.
I was like, winter has arrived. So that was refreshing. Because, like I said, I feel like there's a lot of criticism. And if we would have had more time, I would have probably asked Laura to uncomfortably have talked about if it made her uncomfortable as a woman. But to see some of these, like this concept of, you know, it's still a princess who's pining after a prince to some degree. But I thought this movie, more than almost any other princess movie, where there is a prince involved that she ends up with. Basically having that, like, caveat all around Frozen. That it, you know, it wasn't just about, like, oh, I need completion through a man. Mm-hmm. I need, you know, he's pretty or she's pretty. I kind of like to take her to my secret garden swing place. You know, like there seemed to be more to it than that. And I think it would have been easy for them not to do that, seeing as how they were trying to just kind of do a straight adaptation mm-hmm. or whatever, or retelling, as it were. So I like I said, I really appreciated that. I felt like there was a connection there, and I think that. That and the relationship that we saw, even though I wish there was, I almost wanted to see more of it, mm-hmm. but I really didn't want the movie to be any longer, so I don't know how I would have done it. The relationship that Kit had with his father,
yeah,
like the king, because I just thought that was, I thought that was a really sweet relationship. I remember thinking, like, typically when I watch fairy tales like this, like, the king's a jerk
mm-hmm.
yeah.
or the prince is, like, undeserving or has, like, a real big lesson he needs to learn
right.
about how to stop being a jerk prince. But I was like,
AKA the Beast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But all, you know, they were like, hey, we make these decisions. But just because it's what's done doesn't mean it's what should be done. You know, they're just waiting to kind of have that feel in there. So that I really appreciated that about the movie.
Yeah.
So
I loved this so much because I was really, I've been struggling with the whole, like, since Frozen came out, and then Maleficent did something very similar that basically I felt like I was being fed this message that it's not okay to want this true love to pursue you and come rescue you. And I feel like I identify so much with that theme at the heart of what that means that I didn't want that to be tainted for me, I guess. And I feel like this film like does justice to that kind of story, but without making it fluffy and nothing. You know what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to believe that your love is like a storybook story.
Yes, I do with the storybook story. And also, it feeds into this whole thing that, anyway.
That wasn't Disney. I kind of cheated.
You did. Well, you've been cheating a lot.
Whoa.
One thing that I didn't get to say, like, back in the very beginning when we were talking about people who are who only see Cinderella as weak, is that I feel like as a woman in this particular century, I'm being told that in order to be a strong woman, I have to be really ambitious. I have to want to make all the money and have all the power and not be a stay-at-home mom. Like, there are so many things that are, that with a certain type of feminism, I feel like are desires of my heart that are told that they're wrong and they're oppressive and I'm being brainwashed.
Basically, the version of ladyhood that Lady Tremaine stands for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Having, like, all the nice things, like, being the best, the most beautiful, the most powerful.
Whatever. Yeah, it says you should have the freedom to do whatever you want as long as it's not this one thing.
Yeah. But, anyway, I just feel like that's not every woman's story. That's not what every woman wants. And so I felt validated as a woman who I love to serve. I love to be in the background. I love to be a homemaker. I want to be a mother. I mean, you know, like, that there's also actual strength and power there, and that's a choice, too, and that's strength as well. So, anyway.
Well said.
This final thought brought to you by Laura Temple.
Yeah, there you go. Is that my final thought?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't have to be. I was gonna transition to final thoughts, but then you just broke out into it, and I was like...
That's fine. That can be my final thought.
I was like, well, she's testifying. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to get up in the way. Bishop Eddie Long will stop me. So Joe, you got any final thoughts?
Sure. I think that one of the things I really enjoy about this movie is that it's difficult to exhaust all of the pieces that we could make a conversation about.
Mm-hmm.
We've said a lot, and I still feel like, you know, we've probably covered about 70% of what's worth discussing, and we don't need to carry it any further. But one thing that I think some of the skeptics in our audience may feel is that we're being biased towards our background, religious background, and that we kind of view the film a little bit too innocently and naively. I want to admit that, you know, it's sort of a messy art. This film could have gone off the rails really easily, and there will be other people who will see very different things in this movie than we will, and I can see why. It depends on your vantage point. Are you starting from every movie that comes down the pike has to be an example to modern day children of what, you know, we stand for today in our culture? Well, it's really practically impossible to do, right? Because Cinderella wasn't made just for me and you in America. This was made for children all over the world. Like, domestically, mm-hmm. they made a lot of money off of Cinderella, but worldwide is why they make money off of this movie. And that's just the way the box office works now. There is a mixed message in this movie, and I think we have already acknowledged that. But one very clear evidence of it was, come the credits, there was a song that started the very beginning of the credits, and it was a song by Sana Relay, something like that, and it's called Strong. And here are the lyrics, and this is a great example of how I feel like this being the movie, it suggests to me that some people involved in the making of the movie really just don't agree with us about what the movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
And here were the lyrics. In a perfect storybook, the world is brave and good. A hero takes your hand, a sweet love will follow. But life's a different game, the sorrow and the pain. Only you can change your world tomorrow. Let your smile light up the sky. Keep your spirit soaring high. Trust in your heart and your sun shines forever and ever. Hold fast to kindness. Your light shines forever and ever. I believe in you and in me. We are strong. When once upon a time in stories and in rhyme, a moment you can shine and wear your own crown. Be the one that rescues you. Through the clouds, you'll see the blue. Trust in your heart and in your sun shines forever and ever. Hold fast to kindness. Your light shines forever and ever. I believe in you and in me. We are strong. I mean, I don't know if you caught the theme there, but it seems to be about you and me.
Yeah, so...
we are the masters of our destiny.
I'm really glad that you went through the lyrics of that song, because it reminded me that I need to go back, like, two things and talk about my real come on moment of this movie.
Which is that song.
Which was having to listen to that song during the credits.
There you
because
go.
Because I thought that song was terrible.
Agreed. So agreed.
I mean, and not just because the lyrics are terrible, but because the song, I was like, who is singing this? This is terrible.
Agreed.
The thing I noticed at the end was that, like, Kenneth Branagh helped write it, and I was like, is he just doing this? Because, you know, Cinderella's not going to win, like, Best Picture, you know? Because it's just not the type of movie that, you know, so he's trying to get in there to get, like, Best Original
Best
Song. And I'm like,
sorry,
oh.
Kenneth. Sorry.
I was like, sorry, Kenny, baby. This song is terrible. So that's my real come-on moment. We were doing really bad dancing in the theater after that to how bad that song was. But to your bigger point, Joe, I agree. I do think it's really interesting that they obviously didn't have the same perspective, and they're the ones making the movie, right?
Yes.
That was a pregnant pause there. I was going to be like, Joe, are you with us, Joe?
I thought that was rhetorical. Sorry.
Oh, no, I like, you know, feedback. Well, let me say this to kind of close this out. You know, I didn't love this movie as much as Laura or Joe did. I did think it was really well done. I did enjoy it. But I think it mostly has to do with the fact that I've never really liked Cinderella as a story, especially of all the Disney movies that I could choose from.
That's your problem.
But that probably is. That did taint it. Because I didn't even want to see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping I could skip it. Altogether,
and I was like, "No, no, sir."
but it got really favorable reviews. I had people telling me that I should probably go check it out, and we did, and I'm glad I did. So I would say towards the end of the movie, it was almost over, and I remember having this very out of body thought where I was like, "I don't really like Cinderella that much as a story," for reasons that I haven't really explored, but enough to make me not really excited to see it, especially when I knew it was going to be made like a year in advance. But right there towards the end of the movie, I remember thinking, you know what? I think this is the best version of Cinderella that I've ever seen. And I was actually excited. And I think it's because of that tone that we talked about when we kicked off the show with. That tone that movie took. I want to watch it with children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, I can't wait to watch it with hopefully my children someday or someone else's children. I just think it's a really great and fun and, to a certain degree, innocent movie. And so even though, like I said, it's still not like my favorite movie or anything like that, mm-hmm. I definitely did, that tone stuck with me. And I would say that if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Cinderella yet, well, one, I mean, I guess you kind of knew that, you probably knew the story anyway because it's a pretty common story, but you should really take the time to watch this film, especially if you have children, you know. I just think it's a good film. It, like Joe has pointed out, there's so many things that you can start conversations with. Hopefully, unlike Joe, your daughter won't like one of the stepsisters. You know, that's a different kind of thing Joe's going to have to address
maybe
later.
Maybe she just knows something we don't know.
Maybe she does. Mm. Maybe. So yeah, I really encourage anyone to see. I think this is a, you know, fun for all ages kind of movie. So I hope more people go see it. It's really good. It's real worth your time. And with that, I want to give my wonderful guests, who I know you've all enjoyed listening to, a chance to talk about how you can continue the conversation with them or follow the work that they do all around the interworld. So,
Interworld is actually a novel by Neil Gaiman.
What? See, I don't know things like that. That's like what smart people would know. That's why I married you, so I gotta know things like that. So, Joe, how can people follow your work?
I am _ Joe Darnell on Twitter, and I talk there. You can reach me there. Start up a conversation. I am on another movie podcast, also a coffee show and a tech show I just started. So those are moviebite.com, topbrew.fm, and Tectonic. That's TECH tonic.fm respectively. And real-time follow-up here, just for a second. I double-checked on the two Snow White movies that were made a few years ago. Neither of them were tied to Disney.
Oh.
And I thought one of them was.
Well, so then.
That's good news. Maybe we'll get a good live-action Snow White in a few years.
Nice.
With Peter Dinklage as the head dwarf.
Hmm.
Like, just...
Don't you think he's tired of being typecast?
I think he's not tired of having lots of work and money. And he's a pretty good actor, so...
That's true.
So, Laura, if I were to try to find you somewhere besides this room right now...
I was literally trying to check and make sure I knew what my Twitter handle was, but I'm pretty sure it's Laura_Fissel. I always forget that. Anyway,
I never tweet myself.
I don't, it's true. But like at Laura_Fissel. And my website is laurafissel.com. And I try to post something that inspires me every week on Thursday. And I've recently been doing some sneak peeks of novels and reviews that I've been writing. I also write reviews on Doctor Who over at realworldtheology.com. And those are coming with more frequency now that the overlord of real world theology has given me deadlines, monthly deadlines.
Cracking that whip.
That's right. So anyway, yeah, you can find my stuff there. I think there are even links to the Who posts over at my website.
Well, you can follow me at Physification. On Twitter, or you can follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, you can visit realworldtheology.com. Hopefully you've already found it and found the show and the show notes. That's R-E-E-L worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook. Lots of you do that. We love interacting with you guys. We love just getting feedback and keeping the conversation going. So subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Subscribe to it on Stitcher if you prefer Stitcher. If you enjoy it, please, please, please review the show. Let's, you know, like bump our ratings. Let's get on up there. Let's get some more listeners. Let's get some more people involved in these conversations, because what makes these so interesting is getting all these different perspectives and continuing that 30% of conversation that we haven't had yet about this movie, either on the site or on Facebook or someplace like that. So, you know, like I said, leave feedback, interact with us. You know, tweet the guests. They come on not just because I beg them. They want to talk about these movies. So if you want to talk about these movies with them, they're just a tweet away. So thank you so much for being here, Laura and Joe.
Sure thing.
Thank y'all. Great show, sir.
Well, I mean, I thought it was pretty great. But it's really great because you, the listeners, make it great.
Whatever, it was all us.
The world's greatest audience.
That's right. You're just the best fans. The best audience. So, you know, thank you, listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week or your day or your month or whenever you get a time to listen or get a chance to listen to this show. And until next episode, what? Are you waving?
No, I was about to say, do you ever, like, shout out to listeners who you know are, like, faithful fans?
Well, I don't want to, like, necessarily play favorites.
No.
But
I do. Go for it, Laura. People? Who?
Yeah, you can do whatever you want.
I was going to be like, hey, David Stanley, how you doing?
Well, there you go. So, now
I'm sorry, that's why I waved my hand like, can I talk?
No, I'm all kerfuffled now.
I'm sorry.
And I have a
rewind.
Until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
All right, Mikey.
Are we done?
Yeah,
we are.
Go ahead.
Are we sure?
Yeah.
Night, guys.
Thanks, Joe.
Bye, Joe.
enjoy your secret garden and stuff.
Oh, wow.
Oh, dude.
At least I have something to put at the end of the show now.